Our West Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. In the Iraqi capital, protesters withdrew from Baghdad's highly secured Green Zone, seat of the central government and foreign embassies, where they had staged a sit-in since Saturday. The protesters, led by Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, briefly occupied parliament after weeks of political wrangling and increasing instability. Sadr has been demanding a new government of technocrats and reform. Parliamentary Speaker Salim al-Jabouri called on the country's political parties to back reform. Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has been unable to deliver real change as political parties block the majority of his lists of candidates. James Jeffrey, former U.S. diplomat posted to Baghdad, says the political infighting pits Sadr against supporters of former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki.
First of all, they were the forces of former Prime Minister Maliki, who didn't want to see Abadi's reform program carried out because it undercuts Maliki's power in the parliament. And the other is Muqtada al-Sadr's group, which wanted to see even more technocratic members of parliament and even more of an overturning of the political party landscape in the parliament and in the government.
Meanwhile, the Islamic State claimed responsibility for bombing Sunday that killed more than 30 in the southern city of Samawa. The death toll from a building collapse in Nairobi has risen to at least 16, with many said to still be trapped in the rubble. The residential structure, built next to a river, is believed to have given way following torrential rains. It had earlier been condemned, but had not yet been torn down. President Uhuru Kenyatta, who visited the rubble site on Saturday, said the people inside the building died unnecessarily and their deaths, he said, were caused by corruption. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has called on Russia to help revive a U.S.-Russian brokered ceasefire that has all but collapsed as Syrian forces intensify attacks, especially in the largest city, Aleppo, over the past 10 days. Kerry spoke in Geneva, citing those suspended talks.
I hope in the course of the conversations that I have here tonight, tomorrow, and the work that our teams are doing, importantly, we have teams meeting even today, tomorrow, in order to try to zero in on and pin down the modalities of reaffirming the cessation. And so these are critical hours. We look for Russia's cooperation. We obviously look for the regime to listen to Russia and to respond to the international community's powerful statement through the UN Security Council.
Russia Sunday said new talks are underway to halt the bombardment of Aleppo. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said nearly 250 civilians have died in shelling, rocket fire, and air raids since April 22nd. Two policemen were killed, more than 20 people wounded Sunday, following a car bomb blast near the entrance to a police station in the southern Turkish city of Gaziantep, near the Syrian border. No immediate claim of responsibility. The director of Central Intelligence, John Brennan, Sunday marked the fifth anniversary of the killing of Al-Qaeda mastermind Osama bin Laden by being asked on U.S. television if the same fate awaits Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
If we got Baghdadi, I think it would have great impact on the organization, and it will be felt by them. But this is a large, not just organization, it's a phenomenon. We see it not just in Syria and Iraq, we see it in Libya, Nigeria, and other countries. So we're going to have to remain very focused on destroying all the elements of that organization.
He also said there's no evidence indicating Saudi Arabia gave backing to al-Qaeda for the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on New York and Washington. From Moscow to Madrid, May Day protesters on Sunday demanded higher wages, better conditions, and more job security. French and Turkish police used tear gas to break up protests. Workers across Asia called for higher wages and better working conditions. Protests also held in the U.S. and Latin America. Venezuela's president has ordered a 30-day increase in the country's minimum wage. Nicolas Maduro's announcement coming as the South American country experiences rampant inflation and economic stagnation. Another chapter in revived U.S.-Cuban relations opened Sunday with the first commercial passenger cruise ship to sail to Cuba from the U.S. in more than 50 years. And the experimental solar-powered Solar Impulse 2 scheduled to take off Monday from California's Mojave Desert to Phoenix, Arizona, the next leg of its round-the-world trip. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. An Amnesty International official says detained Gambian opposition members are prisoners of conscience and should be released.
The Gambian constitution protects the right to freedom of expression and freedom of assembly, including peaceful protest. And international law is very clear that there should be no criminalization of people who've been taking part in peaceful protest.
Stephen Colburn is Amnesty International Deputy Regional Director for Western Central Africa. South Sudan's transitional cabinet has been sworn in, and Comoros Constitutional Court orders the rerun of the April 10 presidential election in 13 areas.
Those who have not been able to cast their vote are about 6,000. So for the court, these people could have changed the outcome of the vote, and that's why rerun has to be done in those 13 stations.
Mohamed Untagaman is president of the Consumer Society of the Comoros Islands. The Khartoum government denies it prevented the holding of a media symposium. The U.S. Department of Labor says Africa's dependence on child labor affects development, and cigarette smoking is on the rise, particularly in poor countries. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An Amnesty International official says members of the Gambian opposition arrested last month by President Yahya Jammeh's government are prisoners of conscience and should be released because they were simply expressing their political opinion as guaranteed under Gambian constitution. This came after Gambian authorities over the weekend charged 38 people arrested last month, including main opposition leader Usainu Dabo of the United Democratic Party, with conspiracy to commit a felony. They had previously been charged with unlawful assembly, rioting, and incitement to violence after they held a rare opposition protest demanding political reforms and against the death of UDP official Solo Sendeng in custody. Stephen Colburn, Amnesty International Deputy Regional Director for Western Central Africa, says the death of Solo Sendeng must also be investigated.
The Gambian constitution protects the rights to freedom of expression and freedom of assembly, including peaceful protest. And international law is very clear that there should be no criminalization of people who've been taking part in peaceful protest, even if there has not been the authorization granted to that. So for us, these are prisoners of conscience. These are people who have expressed their political opinion and they've been arrested and charged for that, and they should be released. Beyond that, there is also very, very serious allegations made against the Gambian authorities in terms of the violence that they used against these protesters and the violence they used once they were in prison. We know of one person, Solo Sendeng, who died in custody, which of course is acceptable under no circumstances. There must be an investigation of this violation of human rights. So our view is very clear. If people were not using violence, and we believe this was a peaceful protest, they should be released. And everyone should be treated correctly according to the law.
You mentioned that Mr. Dabo and the others that were arrested, they should be going to trial. Even your organization has questioned or has highlighted the human rights situation in the Gambia. How confident are you that a trial will be transparent and fair?
I think there would be a lot of questions raised about the fairness of any trial going forward. Of course, there are a long history in the Gambia of problems around politically motivated trials, about lawyers and families having access to people who have been charged, and the use of torture in the prisons and the penal system, which of course can make people leak to confessions that would then be used. So there's a huge amount of problems in terms of the whole criminal justice process in Gambia, independent of the judiciary. So I think we would have some major questions about the fairness of any trial that is as politically sensitive as this one. I think what we very much hope would be that the Gambian authorities would take a step back from this situation. You know, we're in a year when there are elections to be held in 6 months or so, or 7 months or so. There needs to be a position of national dialogue between the political parties, of trust, of confidence, an environment where people can express their views and assemble peacefully. And I think what would be important to try and build that confidence would be to release these protesters and to open an investigation into the death in custody of one of them.
Has your organization made any representation with the Gambian government?
We are co currently writing a letter to the Gambian government with our concerns. And of course, we know that many other statements from the United Nations, from the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, from the European Union, from ECOWAS. There's been a huge amount of different organizations around the world, including our own, who've called for these protesters to be released, who've called for there to be an investigation of death in custody. And I think it's really, it would be an important thing for Gambia to be able to listen to those calls and to take a step back away from the situation that we find right now.
Stephen Coburn is Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for Western Central Africa. He was speaking with me from Dakar, Senegal. The people of the Comoros Islands are gearing up for a rerun of their April 10 presidential election in 13 polling areas. The country's constitutional court ordered the rerun over the weekend because of widespread irregularities in those areas. Partial results of the April 10 elections gave victory to former coup leader Azali Assoumani with about 41% of the vote, while Comorian Vice President Mohamed Ali Sole got about 40%. Sole challenged the results because he said results from those 23 areas, polling stations, were likely to favor him. Mohamed Umchagama, president of the Consumer Society of the Comoro Islands, describes the court ruling as unprecedented.
The reason given are that the citizens, the inhabitants of those stations in those villages have been prevented to cast their vote. Therefore, the Constitutional Court says that they have been denied their human rights. And as such, the state has to ensure that they vote. Moreover, the difference between the provisional winner, Colonel Azali, and the follower is a difference about of 1.1% in terms of voices. It's about 2,600-900 voices. And those who have not been able, according to the court, to cast their vote are about 6,000. So for the court, these people could have changed the outcome of the vote, and that's why a rerun has to be done in those 13 stations.
So are you saying that the rerun of this election would make a difference in terms of who is going to be elected president of Comoros?
That is the opinion of the court, yes.
Has this kind of thing happened before in the Comoros?
It has never happened. Some lawyers say that you cannot have partial rerun, you know, in some election. It was not, the law doesn't say anything about that.
Mr. Azali is claiming to have won or is leading with 40.98% of the vote.
Yeah.
Mohamed Ali Saleh, did he represent the party in power?
Yeah. In fact, many say here that it is strange because in this situation, it's from the government side that is saying that opposition would have committed irregularities, you know. So it is a bit strange, you know, for the population.
Can it be interpreted as the party in power trying to manipulate its way to stay in power?
Well, the opinion here, I mean, parts say that this has never happened. Many could use this situation to call for violence, but he is ready to go again for a rerun, you know. On the other hand, from the government side, they welcome the court's decisions. So far, Azali has been careful not to accuse the government simply because the president of the republic, he tends to appear neutral, even though his government, you know, supports clearly his vice president.
The rerun is supposed to take place what time, what day?
We will know that for sure tomorrow, but according to the constitution, the new president should take his oath on the 26th of May. Now there will be elections on the 15th. Will they be held in time? And if not, what would happen if on the 26th there's not a new president?
Mohamed Umchagama is president of the Consumer Society of the Comoros Islands. He was speaking with me from the capital, Moroni. Today is Monday, May 2nd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Cabinet ministers of South Sudan's new transitional government of national unity were sworn in last Friday, bringing together for the first time in more than 2 years politicians from Riek Machar's rebel movement, the South Sudan government, and the SPLM former detainees. Wakil Simon Wudu was at the swearing-in ceremony in Juba and has this report.
The ministers of the new government of transitional unity were sworn in after their names were announced in a presidential decree read on the South Sudan television. They took the oath of office before President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar. Both leaders spoke shortly after the swearing-in ceremony was over, reiterating their pledge to cooperate and move the country out of its economic crisis and insecurity. President Kiir called for teamwork.
The responsibility imposed on us by the agreement needs each and every one of us to contribute to the stabilization of our country. There is no blame that it was you who did this or who did that. If we do that, we will not move an inch. But if we forget about all what happened and start with a clean page, we will move.
Machar says addressing the country's chronic insecurity is a top priority.
So we are now in a cabinet. It's our task to ensure that this challenge, we overcome it sooner, not only in Juba, all over the Republic. So once we stabilize the security, our economy will be stabilized. We should work to ensure that the South Sudanese power.
The new cabinet is comprised of 30 ministers. Mr. Kiir appointed 16, the SPLM IO appointed 10, and the SPLM former detainees and other opposition political parties appointed 2 each. Many of the government's appointees are returning ministers. Among some of the familiar faces with the government are Kwal Manyang Juk, who headed the Ministry of Defense, Michael Makwelweth, who headed the Information Ministry, and Obutu Mamur Mete, who headed the Security and Service Ministry. Among the new faces includes Dr. Diu Mathok, Minister of Energy and Mining, Dr. Diop Bichok, Minister of Petroleum, and Mabior Garangdi Mabior, son of South Sudanese hero. The late Dr. John Garangdi Mabior heads the Ministry of Water Resources and Irrigation. Simon Monoja, Associate Professor at the University of Juba in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology, says he does not trust the leadership of the new cabinet because many ministers are familiar faces who have done nothing to help the country in the past.
There's no difference. These are the same people who led us into war, and now they're back. I hope they will begin to think anew. Let them think anew, not the old way.
Monoja says the new cabinet had better demonstrate real leadership if it is going to regain the trust of the South Sudanese people. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
The Sudan government has denied its national intelligence and security services on Saturday prevented the journalist network from holding a symposium to discuss government plans aimed at integrating daily newspapers into a limited number of press institutions. Minister of Information Ahmed Bilal says the government is doing the newspapers a favor by asking them to consolidate.
Actually, as I told you, they called first of all on Friday for demonstrations and they called people to come and to do demonstrations after the Jum'ah pray. And nobody actually came and nothing happened. So they again they called for another on Saturday and the same happened. Nobody actually that depending on the students to make demonstrations and to make intifada. Nobody actually is joining them, and this is the opposition, and these allegations coming from the opposition. I tell you now, Khartoum is very quiet. Nobody is prevented from moving. Nobody prevented from his expression. Nothing happened, and everything is normal.
But does your government have any plan to integrate daily newspapers into a limited number of press institutions?
This is actually a suggestion from the government that if they make some sort of coalition, some sort of 3, 4, 5, 6 newspapers, then we can support them. And this is from our side as a government, as just a suggestion. We have no tools and we have no actually any sort of law which can comply them to do that.
Is it true that you support the newspapers and you are calling for this integration so as to cut down costs? Is that correct?
The integration actually, because, you know, our newspapers are very poor now. Mostly they can even, they have about 3,000 or 4,000 at maximum. Some of them have 30 publications. But if they make big companies and they join together, they can make more than that. And we can actually help as government by giving them loans. But owners of newspapers, the government cannot make any sort of support for them. They make integration and these big companies, this will help them, and we can, as government, we can support.
So, Minister, every time we talk with you, you talk about freedom of the press and freedom of speech. If this suggestion goes ahead, wouldn't that be suppressing freedom of speech or freedom of the press?
On the contrary, we want to help them. We are not really making this by law. They are free. They still are going on and they refuse. They refuse the integration. Nothing happens and we are not going to make it by force.
Ahmed Bilal, Sudan's information minister, he was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. As Africa develops economically, much of the progress is being carried on the backs of children. Child labor is rampant across much of Africa, and governments face a massive challenge in trying to minimize and eventually eliminate it. But as VOA's Jeffrey Young reports, the problem appears to be growing in some places.
As sub-Saharan Africa strives to break the shackles of poverty, its population of nearly 1 billion people is hard at work. A 2014 report by the U.S. Department of Labor concluded that one out of five sub-Saharan children are working under difficult, if not squalid, conditions. In a Skype interview from South Africa, the International Labor Organization's Alex Soho said poverty is a driving force behind child labor.
They are poor, the income is low, they cannot afford hiring adult labor, so they have to rely on the work, you know, of their kids. This is true for farmers, this is true also for farm workers, who have to take along with them, you know, into the plantations, in particular, the whole family, you know, to complete the task they've been assigned.
For these children, daily life consists of more than just backbreaking labor. Hazardous, dangerous conditions are commonplace, not just on the farm where machinery meant to be run by adults poses threats to children and pesticides abound, but also in mining, where conditions are sometimes abominable. Day after day, children stand in muddy creeks and rivers scouring the water for specks of gold dust. There are dangers everywhere. Machinery, man-sized or bigger rocks, hazardous chemicals, and waterborne diseases. Another sub-Saharan African industry dependent on child labor is cocoa, used in the production of chocolate. That U.S. Labor Department report said child labor is prevalent on cocoa plantations in Cameroon, Ghana, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. In two other nations, Ivory Coast and Nigeria, it's not only the children are working, they are being forced to work. What's worse, the use of children in the cocoa industry is increasing. A study by Tulane University found that the number of children working in the cocoa industry in 2013 and 2014 was 51% higher than 5 years earlier. The Tulane report said 1.4 million sub-Saharan African children were working in the cocoa industry in 2014. Alex Soho and others say keeping kids in school and helping families pull themselves out of poverty are the keys to helping the people of Africa achieve the kind of growth they need to improve their position in the global marketplace. Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
The number of adult cigarette smokers worldwide is increasing, particularly in poor countries, despite the adoption of a global treaty on tobacco control. However, one of the frameworks of the Tobacco Convention says reductions in smoking and deaths caused by tobacco use are achievable. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
An estimated 740 million adults worldwide use tobacco daily. Since 1980, there's been a 41% rise in the number of men who smoke regularly and a 7% increase among women. In 2005, the World Health Organization adopted the Framework on Tobacco Control, an international treaty calling on countries to take measures to discourage tobacco use. Some 180 countries are signatories, and where there's strong anti-smoking laws, evidence shows tobacco use goes down, according to Laurent Hubert, the executive director of Action on Smoking and Health. Uber led non-governmental organizations in helping to put together the framework. France is an example of the impact of anti-tobacco measures. Uber points to the country's adoption of a stiff tax on cigarettes. He says the tax slashed cigarette smoking nearly in half, but it went up again by 7% between 2014 and 2015, when the country failed to adjust the tax to keep pace with inflation.
But it's not, as some people sometimes ask, is this about banning or making the product illegal? And that's not what it's about. It's about regulating the product so we can avoid the large public health impact it has and decrease prevalence of smoking to very low levels.
Tobacco kills 6 million people a year, says Uber, and 1 billion people are projected to die by the end of the century. 80% of countries require cigarette packs to display graphic images. But in some countries, like India, factions influenced by big tobacco companies are fighting back, and it's hard to get anti-smoking measures enacted. Uber is optimistic that the target to reduce cigarette smoking worldwide will be met. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with rugby. Samoa edged Spain 38-32 to win the World Rugby Under-20 Trophy in Harare, Zimbabwe on Sunday. Fiji beat Namibia 44-30 in the bronze medal playoff. The United States of America pipped Uruguay 32-30 to claim the fifth place, while Hong Kong edged Zimbabwe 44-40 to place seventh. Turning to volleyball, Egyptian defending champions El Ahly beat Tunisia's Carthage in sets of 25-20, 22-25, 25-20, 20-25 and 15-13 to retain their Africa Women's Volleyball Club Championship title in the Tunisian capital Tunis on Saturday. Earlier on, Kenya Pipeline beat Rwanda Revenue Authority by 3-1 in the bronze medal playoff. Egypt's El Sham is fifth, Tunisia's CS Faxian is sixth, Kenya Prisons is seventh, Algeria's GS Petrolia is eighth, Algeria's Wilaya Bejaia is ninth, and Cameroon's FAP is tenth. They are followed by Algeria's Mechal Bejaia, Cameroon's Ingis, Uganda's Ndeje University, Nigeria's Jos South, Cameroon's Bafia, Ghana Police, and Gabon's Ndela in that order. In football news, Zimbabwe, Swaziland, Seychelles and Madagascar are drawn in Group A for the Regional Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup. According to the draws conducted in Johannesburg, South Africa, Malawi, Angola, Lesotho and Mauritius are in Group B. Only winners of the group contest advance to the quarterfinals. Defending champions Namibia meet Botswana and Mozambique play guest side the Democratic Republic of Congo in the quarterfinals. South Africa meet winners of Group B, as Zambia play winners of Group A. The contest will be staged in Windhoek, Namibia, from the 11th to 25th of June. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, May 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that all of you in Africa will have a very, very productive week.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou discusses healthy gums and diet with our guest, Dr. Bruce Seidner, dental surgeon of the Seidner Dentistry and Associates. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.